You're listening to On the Same Page, a podcast from the Jefferson Madison Regional Library.
Welcome back to another episode of On the Same Page. We're your hosts. I'm Abby.
And I'm Katie. We're librarians at the Central Library.
For this episode, we've got a recording of a lecture by UVA's Dr. John Edward Mason discussing the social, political, and artistic impact of acclaimed African-American photographer, writer, and filmmaker Gordon Parks.
But before we get to that, we've got book chat.
Okay, book chat. Katie, what did you read?
Yeah, so I just recently read a book called American Spy by Lauren Wilkinson. So it takes place in like late 1980s, early 1990s. So in America and sort of at the end of the Cold War.
Excellent.
And it's billed as a spy thriller, sort of because the main character is, she's an African-American female working in the FBI.
Okay.
And so she's sort of caught facing a lot of discrimination at work. She's basically a pencil pusher. She doesn't get to go like in the field, so to speak, because of her race and her gender. But she is given this assignment where she's sent to Africa in Burkina Faso, mm-hmm. where there is this up-and-coming political party, the Communist Party. And so mm-hmm. she's sort of sent to infiltrate to see.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Like, it's really, really cool premise because it's based on actual facts, mm-hmm. an actual story. And so it's all about how she gets involved undercover and spy, but she's also kind of facing loyalties to her family uh-huh. back home because her father was a police officer in New York.
And okay.
So it was really interesting. Very good book.
Cool. So sort of like I hesitate to even call that historical fiction, but I know that it is now.
It's sort like of a hybrid.
Yeah. Historical fiction spy thriller. That's cool. That sounds great.
So how about you? What have you read?
I read a young adult novel called The Inexplicable Logic of My Life, and that's by Benjamin Alire Saenz, I believe. So this came out in 2017, and I picked it up because I'd read his previous young adult novel, Aristotle and Dante Discover the Secrets of the Universe, which won all kinds of awards. Mm-hmm. And so this one I was hoping would be, you know, of similar kind of very engaging story. And it was. It's realistic young adult fiction. You know, all of the emotions are very heightened. So you're really just very involved and you care deeply about the characters from like page one. But it follows it's sort of a coming of age story of a teen boy he's a white boy who's the adopted son of a gay Mexican-American man. And so it's sort of navigating that kind of transracial family adoption story, but also being the child of a parent who is not straight, right? So somebody who's kind of marginalized by society in several ways. And it was really good. I really enjoyed it. Again, he's so good with those emotions. He just hits you in the heartstrings. Mm-hmm. But it was great. Lived up to my expectations. So
great. That's good. Because I know Aristotle and Dante,
so
people loved it. So it's good that the second one could live up to the expectations.
Definitely.
So next up, we hear a recording of an event that took place at the Northside Library on Thursday, February 21st. Dr. John Edward Mason, an associate professor with UVA's Department of History, discusses the social, political, and artistic impact of acclaimed African-American photographer, writer, and filmmaker Gordon Parks.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Thank you all for coming out tonight. My name is Evan Stankovics, adult programming librarian here at the Northside Library. We're delighted to have with us this evening University of Virginia professor Dr. John Edward Mason, here to discuss Gordon Parks. This evening's program is also being audio recorded for the JMRL podcast On the Same Page. Documentary photographer, musician, motorsports enthusiast, and of course historian, Dr. Mason teaches African history and history of photography at UVA. Author of two books, he is presently working on Gordon Parks and American Democracy, a book about the ways in which Parks' Life magazine photo essays on social justice and the books that he published during the Civil Rights era challenged Americans' notions of citizenship, and at the same time made him one of the era's most significant interpreters of the Black experience. Dr. Meese will also be participating in this year's Virginia Festival of the Book, where he will moderate a program at the Jefferson School on March 23rd entitled Complicated Lives in the Civil Rights Era. Ladies and gentlemen, please help me welcome Dr. John Evan Meese.
Thank you, Evan, for that introduction, and it's really great to be here. I love spreading the gospel of Gordon Parks. And it's nice to have an audience. Most of you, I won't have to tell you what Life magazine was. I give a lot of talks about Gordon Parks. And, you know, Life magazine was such a dominant force in American culture for so long. And yet, it's been forgotten by people under, well, it's been never known by people maybe under 45 or so. And I'll be talking a lot about Life magazine, Gordon Parks, photographed for Life magazine for about 20 years, and it was through Life magazine that he had his greatest impact, I think, on American culture. And so what I'm going to be talking about is the way that Parks' photographs and the text that he wrote to accompany them really shaped the way that middle-class white Americans understood their black fellow citizens. I think that his impact on American culture between the 1940s and the 1970s was every bit as profound as James Baldwin or Ralph Ellison. And that's a really strong claim to make. But the power of his photographs equaled the power of their prose. So I am going to be talking a lot about the way that photographs and text impact American culture. But since I've got a captive audience, I'm going to talk about a little bit about this, another project that I and people from the Jefferson School African American Heritage Center and Monticello and UVA are working on portraits that were made by Rufus Halsinger, who was a white studio photographer. His studio was on West Main Street. Many of you know Halsinger's photographs of Charlottesville street scenes or prominent citizens. What you may not know is that Rufus Halsinger made 500 portraits of African Americans at the height of Jim Crow, at a time when American visual culture was saturated with the kinds of images that we've been reading so much about over the last 3 weeks in Virginia, right? The blackface and the demeaning stereotypes. And yet Rufus Halsinger was making photographs that look like this one here, and this one here, and this one here, and this one here, and this one here. I mean, photographs of dignity, photographs of beauty and grace, photographs that saw African Americans as something other than these buffoonish caricatures that were so prevalent, but also saw them as something as other than oppressed. And, you know, when people went to Halsinger's studio and dressed in this incredibly beautiful dress, which I think was blue, but I've got an argument with people about that, they wanted photographs that showed them as they saw themselves. And Halsinger, of course, was a businessman. And most important color to him wasn't black or white, it was green. And he knew that he had to please his customer, or they wouldn't come back, and they wouldn't tell their neighbors, and they wouldn't tell their cousins. So we have 500 of these portraits, and we're going to use them as a way of telling a new history of the city of Charlottesville, right? Some of you know this, but what Family Photo Day is, we're inviting members of the community to come in and help us, first of all, identify people in the photographs, because they might have the same photograph in their family album, or they may have seen this face before. We do have a lot of names, and when we have names, we can go to the census of the city directory and birth and death certificates, but we can find out that kind of information. But we want to find out what kind of people they were, you know? We want the kinds of stories that families pass down, and that's what Family Photo Day is all about, is about helping us learn who these folks were as people, as human beings. That's at the Jefferson School. It's on Saturday, March the 9th. Please tell all of your friends to look out for information on Family Photo Day. Okay, back to... Oh, one more. Oh, yeah, this is great. Yeah, this is so great. No, the way this is made is that Halsinger used these big glass plate negatives, and sometimes he would make two images on the same glass plate negative by masking one and making an exposure, and then masking the other side and making an exposure. That was especially important with kids because these were really long exposures. And so the kid had to hold still for like 2 seconds, which is really hard. So you doubled your chances of getting a child in focus by making two. And this one, we just happen to have two incredibly beautiful portraits. But back to Gordon. Gordon Parks was, by the 1960s, he was famous. His photographs for Life magazine had made him famous by the 1960s. He had also started writing. He had published one memoir. He wrote four. He published his first memoir, and he had published an autobiographical novel by the 1960s. CBS News did a special on him. It was called The Weapons of Gordon Parks, 1968. Life and his writing had made him famous. By the 1970s, he had become a celebrity because he'd become a movie maker. And he came from nothing. He really did. Most of the quotes that I'm going to be showing you from Parks are from his various memoirs. And this stubborn need to be somebody. This is somebody who accomplished so much. I mean, he was a great photographer. He was a prolific writer. He was a poet, and he made movies, some of which became very, very successful and made him a wealthy man. He was born in Fort Scott, Kansas, a tiny little town. He was quite a poor family. But as he says in his memoirs, the kind of poverty where you didn't feel it so much as you do in a city. Because his family had a little bit of land, and on that land they had a cow and some chickens. They had a vegetable garden. And, you know, in a small town, everybody knows everybody else. It can help everybody else out when you're in trouble. So when his mother died and he went to live with relatives in St. Paul, Minnesota, which was already a big city, he experienced a different kind of poverty, a kind of poverty where you don't have the milk cow, where you don't have the chickens, where you're not putting up your vegetables that you grow in your garden so that you have them in the winter. It was a kind of urban poverty, and it was really cruel to him. After his mother died, he went to live with relatives. He did not get along with his relatives. He was a teenager, and he was forced into the house of a fairly unwilling brother-in-law. And you can imagine, you know, a 16-year-old coming in, and brother-in-law has his ways. And the brother-in-law tossed him out. He was homeless for a while, had to start supporting himself in a variety of different ways. He's a very talented musician, started playing piano in bars and clubs, played semi-professional basketball, was a waiter, was a dishwasher, was a busboy. I haven't told you when he was born. This is all happening during the 1920s and into the 1930s. So this is happening in the 20s, and then he's going into the Depression. So it's really hard to get a foothold on anything. And I'll stop and say that you probably recognize the woman in the picture. That is Ingrid Bergman, right? Oh. So I was born with a stubborn need to be somebody. He, as I was just saying, really did come from almost nothing. And by 1950, he is a very stylishly dressed Life magazine photographer who has been specifically asked by Ingrid Bergman to be the only photographer who's on the island of Stromboli, that's near Sicily, where this guy, Rossellini, what's Rossellini's first name? Roberto Rossellini? Yeah. Some of you know that they were having a scandalous affair. He was a film director, and they're making a movie, and he's the only photographer they will allow on the island. That she already knew his work from Life magazine and said, him, I want him, and nobody else. But he was a charmer. I mean, he had this just incredible charisma. I've interviewed, I never met him, even though our lives overlapsed. He passed away in 2006, but I was working on other things. But I've interviewed by this time 35 or 40 people who knew him, including his surviving children, two ex-wives, friends, colleagues, Life magazine people, and everybody loved him. Everybody loved the man. And you can kind of see a little bit of that there. So he got to where he wanted to be. But I tell you, you know, his 20s were really hard. And he harks back to his mother all the time. The mother was his lodestone. The mother was I think when he says this in his memoirs, that it was her words that kept him going. It was her words who were his North Star, his compass, his guiding principles. My mother's words rang true in my ears, if a white boy can do it, so can you. And she drummed that philosophy into his head day after day until she had him convinced. And I think that's what helped him go through that period of homelessness, of never finishing high school, of having a series of dead-end jobs, of finally getting on his feet. But he got on his feet by working on the railroad. And he was not a Pullman porter, he was a dining car waiter. But a dining car waiter, it was steady employment, wasn't a whole lot of money, but it was steady. And during the Depression, you wanted steady. But it was also demeaning, right? These are ads, by the way, from Life magazine. And a Pullman porter and a dining car waiter had to perform a role, had to perform that subservient, yes, sir, yes, boss, no, boss kind of role. He writes about it, and he writes about experiencing how demeaning it was. It's also a dead end, right? There's no way of going up from here. You're a dining car waiter. But while working as a dining car waiter, he started seeing copies of magazines that were left on the train by the passengers. Some of them were Life magazine, some of them were Vogue magazine, some of them were Look magazine. But he was starting to see the power of photography and thinking, oh, maybe I can do that. And one of the things about photography is nobody can tell you not to do it. You can go to if you want to learn how to be a sculptor, you have to go to art school. It's, you know, somebody has to let you in. There are gatekeepers, right? And for African Americans at this time, there were plenty of gatekeepers at art schools. You want to learn how to paint with oils, you've got to go to art school. You can do with photography what he did, which is to go to a pawn shop and buy a used camera and buy some film and start making pictures. And he had natural talent for it. I'll say the other thing about Gordon Parks. He had this immense capacity for hard work, but he also had talent. So he buys a camera while he's working on the railroad. 1937, his first roll of film, he takes it to the drugstore. He goes to pick up the prints. The guy behind the counter said, "Who took these pictures?" And Parks said, I took the pictures. The guy says, "These are really good, kid. Keep it up and we'll give you a show." He kept it up. They gave him a show. They gave him a little show. I mean, he had that something. He had the eye. He knew how to make a good picture. So he starts teaching himself photography, which you can do, right? So he's reading all the popular photography magazines. He's going to the bookstore and buying the manuals. As he's also doing this at exactly the right time. And it's the right time in a variety of different ways. It's the right time because photography is really popular. Life magazine starts publishing in 1936. All its competitors start. It's photography has sort of captured the public imagination for the first time. Reproducing photographs and for a mass audience is cheap enough to do in a Life or Look or that kind of magazine. It's also the time when documentary photography is taking off. So some of you have heard about the government agency, the Farm Security Administration, that had had a photographic project that employed some of the finest photographers America's ever produced, like Dorothea Lange and Walker Evans. You know, he's at a moment where photography has tremendous prestige and energy. But also, things are changing racially. Now, we're not going to really see the changes until after World War II. But here's Richard Wright writing, you know, he published this book just before the war, and he's talking about this new energy that he senses among black people. We're the new tide. We stand at the crossroads. We watch each new procession. The hot wires carry urgent appeals. Print compels us. Voices are speaking. Men are moving, and we shall be with them. This became another touchstone for Gordon Parks, you know, that he was of a generation that didn't even have a name yet, but Richard Wright is putting his finger on it. Then when Parks starts working for United States government, starts working for the OWI Office of War Information, he photographs Richard Wright. Richard Wright gives him a copy of this book and inscribes it to him, to Gordon Parks, who marches with the new tide. You want another example of what that new tide was? Think about Jackie Robinson, right? This is that era where we're going to start right after World War too, start having the first black this and the first black that. And, you know, it's the most obvious one was Jackie Robinson integrating Major League Baseball. But it's happening in a variety of different places, and Parks was there at the right moment, at the right time. So his photography leads him to Chicago. In Chicago, he associates himself. He becomes the photographer for the Southside Community Art Center. It's part of an art program that was one of the WPA Depression programs, right? So during the Depression, there were government programs that supported the arts all over the country. And there were these community art centers all over the country, and it's where people could learn how to do art, learn how to paint, learn how to sculpt, learn how to write poetry, etc., and so on. There were some people who later became famous who were associated with that Southside Community Art Center. Gwendolyn Brooks, Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, Elzear Kortor, a painter, VMFA has a number of his paintings, Charles White, another painter. But it was a place where he got hooked up with something called the Rosenwald Fund. And Rosenwald Fund, as many of you know, supported black education, right? You went to Rosenwald School?
Yes.
Fantastic. Yeah. There are a number that are around this area. They supported elementary education, high school education for African Americans when states would not. That's why the Rosenwald School was doing this. But they also had fellowships for black scholars and black artists. And somebody said, Parks, you should apply for one of these because you've got talent and you've got that eye. And he gets a Rosenwald Fellowship, the first one that was ever given to a photographer. And it allows a year of study. And so people were at, you know, the Rosenwald people, I've read the letters, and they're trying to figure out, what does it mean for a photographer to study? Because at that time, there were not schools of photography, right? There, you know, you didn't go to art school to learn photography. What does it mean? And they said, well, what he really needs is an apprenticeship somewhere. What better place to apprentice than with the federal government's Farm Security Administration documentary project in Washington, D.C., where his fellow photographers will be people like Dorothea Lange and Walker Evans. And so off he goes, and now I pass through a new door, and in my most extravagant dreams and ever experienced. I love this picture. You know, it just captures that moment of this just sort of this intense optimism that he has. And he goes down to Washington, D.C. You know, Parks grew up in for his first 15 years in Fort Scott, Kansas, which was a pretty segregated town. The high school was integrated. The elementary schools were not. Blacks had to sit upstairs in the movie theater. You couldn't get a soda at the drugstore. They wouldn't serve it to you. But then he goes to St. Paul, which is different, right? The African-American community in St. Paul and Minneapolis was pretty small. There was a little kind of fluidity. He couldn't get good jobs, but he didn't experience harsh, in-your-face, sort of nasty racism there. He spends a little time in Chicago, but not very long. He goes to Washington, D.C., and he's feeling like this. He's got this Rosenwald Fund. He's come from nothing. He's going to be sort of serving an internship with the Farm Security Administration, and he's going to the capital of democracy. And he's just got this. And, you know, this is the early, I keep not telling you dates. This is early spring of 1942. So we've entered the war. We're fighting for democracy. We're fighting against the bad guys. You know, we're fighting against dictatorship, and we're fighting against Nazi hatred, and we're fighting for freedom and for democracy. So he goes to Washington, D.C. He's just full of himself, but also full of sort of the promise of America. He gets to Washington, D.C., and his new boss, Roy Stryker, a very, very, very astute guy, who was the brains behind this Farm Security Administration documentary project. Stryker looks at him and says, okay, this kid knows nothing. So he says, Parks, this is what I want you to do. Put your cameras away. Parks tells the story in all of his memoirs and all of his interviews. Put your cameras away. I want you to get to know Washington, D.C. I want you to go to Garfinkel's and buy an overcoat. I want you to, you know, relax, go see a movie downtown, and get yourself something to eat. Well, okay, so you know what happens. He goes to a lunch counter. They say, we don't serve at this lunch counter. He goes to the movie theater. They don't even have a balcony for African-Americans, right? And he goes to Garfinkel's, and Garfinkel's won't throw him out, but they won't serve him either, right? So there are all these salesmen standing around trying to ignore him and won't sell him a coat. They will not take his money. And he goes charging back to the office, and he's angry. And he says, give me my cameras. And Stryker says, what are you going to do with them? And he says, I'm going to expose bigotry. He says, how are you going to do it? He says, I'm going to take pictures of bigots. Stryker said, you take a picture of a bigot, doesn't that bigot look just like everybody else? You know, unless that bigot's wearing a hood, the bigot looks just like everybody else. How are you going to do it? And it turned out to be something that he had to think about. He had to think really, really hard. But the training that he had had at the Southside Community Arts Center, where he had been surrounded by so many great artists and thinkers and intellectuals, it had immersed him in social documentary, painting and writing and photography. And he figures it out. He makes his first great picture out of that. He makes this a few months after he gets to Washington, D.C., and it's after that episode where he had been turned away. He experienced, you know, real Southern, you know, Washington, D.C. was a Southern town. He had experienced Southern racism. And he gets to know Ella Watson. He gets to know something about her life. You know, she was employed as a housekeeper, as so many African-American women were. At this point in the federal government, there were almost no African-American stenographers, typists, secretaries, clerks, file clerks. You just couldn't get one of those jobs. You were stuck doing this. Found out that her husband had died young, that she was raising her grandchildren and was had already raised a family, was now raising her grandchildren. She's doing this all on a salary of $1,020 a year. We know that for sure. That was what she was getting paid. And he actually works up to making this photo, but it captures that moment where he experienced that tension that we still haven't resolved between the promise of democracy and the reality of American racism, and it's all there. And it's a really sophisticated photo, and he had seen this. Yeah, I know. He knew what he was doing. This hangs, it was at the Art Institute of Chicago then, it's at the Art Institute of Chicago now. He was absolutely aware of Grant Wood's American Gothic, and he understood that not only do I have the symbolism of the flag, but this image of Ella Watson is going to resonate. It's close enough, it's going to resonate in the American consciousness. He spent a lot of time with Ella Watson. And two things I want to say as I move quickly through these is that photograph of her posed in the flag, he worked his way towards it. He made a lot of photographs of her working in the offices of the federal government. Of course, she worked at night because she was a housekeeper. He made a lot of photographs like this. And then when he saw the flag, he kind of figured out, okay, so how am I going to make this photograph work? He's thinking like an artist as well as a documentarian. And so here's one of the photographs that leads up to the great photographs. And you can see that he's on his way, but he hasn't quite figured out how to make it work yet. The other thing about the Ella Watson photographs, he spends a lot of time with her. He spends about a month. And he learns how to make a photo essay, the kind of telling a story through photography that Life magazine was already doing, right? You know, he doesn't know he's going to be working for Life at this point, but he's learning what it takes to do a Life photo essay. This is just a picture of her neighborhood looking out her window. But Jane found this very view on, or pretty close to this view on Google Street View for me. It's hilarious. And he goes to her church and he goes to her neighborhood and he's able to tell a story about Ella Watson's life. Right? And, you know, so he does make that iconic photograph where she stands in for the American dilemma. But he also makes her an individual in this photo series. This is, I'm not going to make the claim that this is the greatest photo series ever made, but I am saying that he's learning how to do what he will do so well for Life magazine. So, I don't have to tell you what Life magazine is, and I'm so happy that I don't have to. It was a media colossus. There's nothing that we have, because I say this to all audiences, so forgive me for telling you what you already know. When Life starts publishing, there's no television, right? There's no television. And even well into the 50s, we forget this, there was no television news. Television news doesn't show up until the end of the 1950s, and then you get like 20 minutes, right? That's all you get. There's no internet. What there isn't is this avalanche, this waterfall, this ocean of images that we are immersed in now, that people were hungry to see what the world looked like, and that's why people loved Life. And it had tens of millions of subscribers, but you also saw it, the doctor's office, the beauty shop, the barber shop, you saw it at your neighbor's house, somebody left it on the bus. I mean, Life was just everywhere. Politicians wanted to be on the cover of Life. Movie stars wanted to be on the cover of Life. Baseball players wanted to be on the cover of Life. Be on the cover of Life. I mean, it was for a celebrity where you wanted to be. And it's where Parks wanted to be. Because his experiences of poverty and his experiences of racism had done two things. It made him very ambitious. So he wanted to become successful and wealthy. But he also wanted to use his camera as a weapon against injustice. And that's a phrase he used a lot, a weapon against injustice. And so he gets to Life magazine. This is actually not one of his pictures on the cover, but I want to show you this issue. So he shoots this, this is 1952, and by this time he's been at Life on the staff for 3 years, and he had spent a year freelancing for Life before he went on the staff. But one of the things that Parks would say to me is, he would say, you know, be careful, Mason, don't paint me into a corner, because you're going to spend this talk talking about all the stuff I did on race and poverty, and I did a lot of other kind of photography. So in this one issue, this issue here, he's got three photo essays. First one is a visualization of Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man. And if you've read that novel, you know it's a very complex and kind of surreal novel. And he figures out a way to, in this case, he's kind of literally visualizing one of the scenes. But in the next spread, you can see that he's interpreting scenes in the novel. Well, this is also pretty literal, but over on the other side, it's not literal at all. He and Ralph Ellison were good friends, and they worked together on this, right? So this is one of the things where he is interpreting the African-American experience for Life's vast middle-class, mostly white audience. But he was a really good fashion photographer. Same issue, he's got this fashion spread. And, you know, he's got a great sense of how to use color. Also, this is 1952, and just imagine an outdoor fashion shoot where you have this very dark-skinned African-American man photographing these beautiful young white models, and you would say, wow, how did he get away with that? I mean, didn't somebody come along and try to lynch him or something? And I don't know. I mean, they're in New York. I think that's Columbia University. That's my guess. Could be CUNY. Does anybody know where that probably is? Any New Yorkers here? CUNY or Columbia, somewhere like that. In any case, he was a really good fashion photographer. He loved fashion. You saw that first photograph of him. He was a clothes horse himself. He loved fashion. He shot fashion his entire life. His second wife was a fashion model. But, you know, the other assignment from the editor was go make pictures of Alexander Calder and try to find a way to bring his sculptures, his mobiles, you know, try to find a way to make those work on the printed page. And he does, you know. I mean, he absolutely does. It's really remarkable, the range, and within a single issue. But he did that throughout his career. He absolutely did. He had this incredible range as a photographer. And I'm going to now move away from his range, and I'm going to put him in that little box, because I think the box is important. You know, he's photographing basically during the long civil rights movement. He starts working on stories about race in 1948, and his last one is in 1971. And, you know, if you think about what happens between 48 and 71, I mean, his first story is before Brown versus Board of Education, and his last story is after the assassination of Martin Luther King. And he's covering it. And his impact, you know, I've been telling you that he had this big impact on American culture. And how do I know that? And I know it because people wrote about him. But I also know it because I've read the letters that Life's readers sent him. And they sent him hundreds of letters. I mean, he'd publish a big story. And there'd be 250, 300 letters coming in from readers. Most of them praising him, some of them pouring out their hearts, some of them saying, I never knew this. Some of them saying, oh, it's a bunch of, some are angry. But he's getting that kind of response, and he's having that kind of impact. Those letters have been preserved. They're in his archive. They're at Wichita State University, and I have read them. So, in any case, his stories. 1948, Harlem gang leader. You know, we think of gangs, and we think, oh, opium, you know, heroin, cocaine, AK-47s, gangbangers. This is West Side Story gangs. It really is. These are juvenile delinquents. So I want to say that. This is not the kind of gang that we think of now. This is West Side Story kind of gang. But it's, you know, it's a very sympathetic, sort of rounded view. Yes, he is a juvenile delinquent. Yes, he steals bicycles. But it's also looking at, well, what makes this really bright young man do this? And quite a sophisticated and sympathetic view. He did not write the text. He only made the pictures. There's a story on segregation in the South. I'm going to come back to this one. Where he finds a single extended family in 1956 and tells the story of segregation through that family. And we find out, it's got a terrible headline, The Restraints Open and Hidden, but what it's about are how segregation confined this family, kept the members of this family from achieving what they could otherwise. He goes to Brazil and does a story about a deeply impoverished family that live in a favela in Rio, where he's telling a story that could be told about American poverty, but he's telling it in Brazil because we had a lot of concern about if poverty and oppression remains the way it is in Brazil, then maybe the commies will come in. Remembers the middle of the Cold War, and it's being driven by that. But he's developed this incredible visual language, as you can see, this visual language that gets you right to the heart. He's also starting to write. This is the moment where he starts to write, 1961, and it's just excerpts from a diary that he kept while he was on the shoot. But he wanted to write, first of all, he wanted to be a writer. Second of all, he knew that when I send my images into life, when I send my photographs into life, the editor can do anything he wants to, and it was always a he. The editor can do anything he wants to with my photographs. They can choose which photographs to print. They can crop them. They can put them next to whatever they do. They can tell my story themselves. But I've got another layer of a way to address the audience if I start supplying the text. That's what Parks is saying to himself. So he does at this point, and we pick it up here. This is on what used to be called the Black Muslims, the Nation of Islam. It's a time when the nation was really scary to most white people. They thought it was a cult. They thought it was violent. They thought it was dangerous. It was going to be horrible things. And it's an inflammatory headline, but the story itself is, in many ways, trying to back away from that kind of hysteria and tell a more complicated story about the Nation of Islam. I'm going to come back to this, too. He's also writing, as you can see. So, once again, most of the words are his. It's really remarkable, this one, where he writes in the first person, so he uses I, you know, and he talks about when he met Malcolm X, when he met Elijah Muhammad, he talks about I, and he addresses the audience as you. He establishes an I-you relationship. So, you know, not only are his photographs very intimate, but the way that he speaks, you know, this is another silly headline, How It Feels to Be Black, but it's 1963. He becomes life spokesman for blackness, right? And explaining to, literally, you know, you can see how life conceptualizes this audience. They need to be told how it feels to be black. These are excerpts from what becomes one of his memoirs. And once again, he's speaking very, very personally in a way that is unusual for life, because life usually was quite impersonal in its text. But there's even more. The long search for pride. This is more about sort of explaining black people to white people. And we're now in 1963. It's the time of the March on Washington. And it's explaining to white Americans, why are black people so angry? Why are black, what do they want? What do black people want? How are they going to fit into our society? And Parks' text is all about that. But you can also see, you know, the portraits that go along with this, not necessarily that one, but the ones on the side, are about normalizing African Americans, about telling you that African Americans are just like you. He and Malcolm became, this is after Malcolm X's assassination, which was, the day of his assassination, I think, was yesterday. The anniversary of his assassination, I think, was yesterday. Parks and Malcolm X became very close friends. Malcolm X asked Gordon Parks to become one of his daughter's godfather, and Parks was happy to accept. They didn't see eye to eye at all. You know, I mean, Parks, to the extent that he had a religion, was a Christian. He was not a nationalist. He was not a radical. But there was something that brought those two men together, and I won't say that I figured it out yet, although I will say that they shared at least this in common. Malcolm X had worked as a dining car waiter, and so had Gordon Parks, and so did Thurgood Marshall. There are a whole lot of people who did that kind of thing, yeah, because there weren't other jobs. But this is a personal account of Malcolm. He's trying to tell, what he is saying here is that, you know, what do you think about Malcolm X? This demon, this devil, this person who's been pilloried in the press, that's not Malcolm X. Let me tell you who Malcolm X really was. That's what he's up to there. Muhammad Ali wrote a poem for Gordon Parks. he did two stories on Muhammad Ali about 4 years apart, and Ali clearly saw Gordon Parks as sort of an uncle figure. They got along really, really well. And Ali did write a poem for Gordon Parks. Stokely Carmichael did a story on Stokely. This, a really, really powerful piece on poverty in Harlem. I'm going to come back to this. Focuses on one deeply impoverished family. After the assassination of Martin Luther King, life sent him to Atlanta, and he did not take his cameras. He was there to write an essay, and I'm going to get to that essay. It's a really, really powerful essay. It's a really angry essay. These are not his pictures. He wasn't there to take pictures. He was there to write. And he does a story on the Black Panthers, and once again, he got along fine with Eldridge Cleaver and, oh, God, what's Cleaver's wife's name? Kathleen, Eldridge and Kathleen Cleaver. Yeah, well, I'm fine with all of them. They tried to recruit him. He said, no, I can't do that. I'm here to do a story. But he got along with everybody, and he made powerful pictures, too. So let me talk a little bit about this. The first thing to say about this story is that, you know, there's a kind of Grant Wood's American Gothic in the portrait of the two elders of this extended family, and I love the way he's posed them under a portrait of ancestors there. The point of this is that here's a family that's doing everything that American family is supposed to do. You know, they're God-fearing, they're hard-working, they love each other, they take care of each other. You know, everything about this family, they value education, is supposed to lead to success. But it doesn't, because they're black. So we meet various members of the family. We meet the mother and the father. I'm going to skip a page. We meet one of the daughters who's a school teacher. And I know that Northerners, you know, white middle-class Northerners looked at that and said, wait a minute. A teacher is washing her clothes like this? a school looks like that? Yeah, well, they did. We're in Alabama, by the way, if you're wondering. We're in Alabama. And those were the conditions. And, you know, you learn in the text that she gets paid less than white teachers get paid. You get learn in the text that black schools are supported less than white schools are supported. We meet another member of the family, and he's over here. You can't see him very well. But he teaches at Tennessee State, which is a historically black university down in Nashville. But he can't get a job anywhere else because white schools won't hire him, right? He's a biologist. He's got all the degrees he needs, but he is black. And so not only can he not get a job in a white university, and that was true in 1956, but he doesn't even mix with the faculty from Vanderbilt or the other schools, right? He's a biologist, but he's not allowed really to be a full member of the profession. The story was really powerful, and I think it opened a lot of eyes. Parks was really interesting, though. He said in one of his interviews, if I had to do all over again, I'd shoot it in black and white, because color makes poverty look too nice. Yeah, he did. He said that. Any case, I don't think Elijah Muhammad actually said this to him, but he said Elijah Muhammad actually said it to him. Why do you work for the white devils, young man? He wrote this 20 years after the fact. I think it is expressing, though, the doubts that he had about the career choices that he made. So this is another just supremely successful photo essay. On the one hand, you know, it produces what is now a really iconic photograph of him. But it also demythologizes the Nation of Islam. You know, this is about saying, you know, the Nation of Islam really isn't that concerned with white folks. And it wasn't. You know, there's a lot of rhetoric from Elijah Muhammad, and there's rhetoric from Malcolm X. But the day-to-day life of the Nation of Islam is turned inward. It's about transforming the lives of African Americans. And he gets it, right? When he, you know, he spends a lot of time with this particular Brooklyn family and shows that, you know, it's about spirituality, it's about religion, it's also about discipline, it's about education, it's about how you behave, it's about hitching up your pants. It is a way of really undermining the stereotypical ways in which the nation was understood. But in his essay, he's talking about himself and the text that he wrote to go along with this. And this is from Life magazine, and this is after his encounter with Elijah Muhammad, who may or may not have said, "Why are you working for the white devils?" And he's saying, yeah, he's thinking about the choices that he made and getting, what does he say, fulfilling my artistic and professional ambitions in the white man's world and become completely involved in it, distanced from the African-American community. It's quite confessional. And when I read the letters to the editor that follow the stories that he wrote, where you will have somebody saying, I'm a white mother of three who lives in Alabama, and I've never thought of these things before, but your story really powerfully moved me. I'm paraphrasing, but that's a real letter that went to him, handwritten. And there were lots of those where people were sort of using him as a confessor, I mean, saying things to him that they could not say to anybody else. I think it's because he had his own vulnerability that he's talking about. He's opening up himself, and he's inviting people to respond in kind. And he's being really honest. And I think, you know, things that were sometimes hard for the audience to hear, that, okay, so, right? I'm doing everything my people and I are doing everything that America says we should be doing, but America's not reciprocating. America's not reciprocating. And that's going to be a theme, too. Harlan Family, 1968. That's his photograph on the cover of one of the children of this Harlan family. It starts with this spread, and I think I'm about to show you some of the text larger. But from the very beginning, he's establishing an I-you relationship with his readers, right? He's very much addressing his readers at you and pointing a finger at them and saying, what are you going to do about what I'm about to show you? And so here, for I am you, look at me and know that to destroy me is to destroy yourself. We're not far as apart as it may seem. There is something that goes deeper than blood or black and white. And then he rips off Langston Hughes. I too am America. America is me. So, you know, he's put readers on notice, boy. I mean, he's calling you out, and you're going to have to decide what you're going to do about what you see. And this is a family that was really, it was experiencing hard times. The husband would get a job and be laid off, get a job, be laid off. There were, I think, 6 children living at home. The conditions they were living in, they were paying exorbitant rent for an apartment in Harlem, and yet the heat didn't work, and what they're doing here is clustering around the oven to stay warm during the wintertime. Poverty had led to... There was chaos in the family, but the way that Parks tells the story is that if the husband is violent towards the wife, then you can understand where that anger is coming from. And it's not justifying hitting his wife, but it is helping readers understand it. And he ends with this image here. We've gotten to know Bessie through the photo essay. We've seen a lot of pictures of her. We know that she tries to be the glue that holds this family together. She tries to do for this family what Gordon Parks' mother had done for his family. She can't do it, and she's at her wit's end here. And that picture kind of sums it up. There's an incredible outpouring at this point. I want to show you a little bit of his text, though. So that's some text. He's repeating that I am you, staring back at a mirror of poverty and despair. Our common search for a better life, for a better world. I mean, it's offering that possibility of coming together as Americans, but showing that there's a real divide to overcome. This article, more than any of his others, just there was a tremendous outpouring from life's readers. Hundreds of letters poured in. Many of those letters had checks and cash in them. People were saying, what can we do for this family? Can we give the father a job? Can we send money? Can we buy... Life magazine chipped in and bought the family a house in Queens, an African-American neighborhood in Queens, and moved them out of Harlem. It didn't solve all their problems. I mean, you're taking people away from everything that they know, their extended family, their neighborhood, their connections, this, that, and the other. But, you know, that gesture of money pouring into life's offices and life topping up the money and buying a house in Queens, I mean, it just gives you that sense of the effect that Gordon Parks is having on his readers. And then the assassination of Martin Luther King, as it did for so many people. I mean, there was just tremendous anger. I think for Parks, there was heartbreak. In his essay, and remember, these are not his pictures. He was just there to write. And that phrase, a man who tried to love somebody, is from Martin Luther King himself. Martin Luther King once said that when I die, remember me as a man who tried to love somebody. But Parks is heartbroken, and he says, I'm heartbroken because here was a man who did what you said we should do. Here was a peaceful man, a man of peace, a man of the gospel, right? A man of reconciliation, and you shot him down. And it's very direct. We are angry, all of us. Believe this, no matter what anybody else tells you. You have pushed us to the precipice. Of course, we don't blame all of you literally, but we cannot control it deep in our hearts. So it's really quite remarkable that he was given this kind of freedom in a mainstream magazine to be so angry. But he's pretty much speaking for Black America. I mean, I was 14 when Martin Luther King died, and I remember that extraordinarily well, in part because, you know, there was, I was in Cincinnati, Ohio, and Cincinnati, Ohio rioted after the assassination of Martin Luther King, as so many cities did across the nation. Racism still engulfs us, the fires still smolder. He's always going to offer an out. The white man stricken must stay firm in his conscience, the black man must see that he does. If the death of this great man does not unite us, we are committing ourselves to suicide. I mean, he was a really powerful writer. I mean, he didn't have the kind of the elegance of Ralph Ellison or Toni Morrison and you know, the poetry of James Baldwin. But there's kind of a blunt directness to his prose. And once again, readers responded. There's this outpouring. But it's at this moment where Parks was also thinking, wow, I've spent over 20 years trying to teach white America about black America through my pictures and through my words. And this is where we are. This great man has been assassinated. And he starts thinking that maybe he's got to do something else. He's got to turn his attention to something else. And he does. He leaves Life. This is the end of his career at Life magazine. Does a couple of more photo essays for them, but this is basically the end of his career. And he pours his energy into writing. So he writes a series of memoirs. He writes novels. He writes poetry. His earlier books are the best. So if you're looking for one book by Gordon Parks, it's A Choice of Weapons, his first memoir. It's by far and away his best book, I think. But he does. I mean, The Learning Tree was a very popular novel. Published, I think, 1963. It was his first book. It was reviewed in the New York Times, reviewed in Time magazine. It was assigned in the Cincinnati public schools, and I assume schools all over the country when I was in junior high school. So it's it's the word I'm looking for. It's an autobiographical novel of his early childhood. Now a major motion picture. Yes, he was the first African-American to direct a Hollywood studio production. And it was his screenplay of his book. He directed and he was his own cinematographer and he wrote the music. He did all of that. We screened this at the Jefferson School a couple of years ago. Look, it's not a great movie. It's really not. He's really hampered by the cast. He just didn't have a cast who could carry this movie. And if I named the cast members, it wouldn't ring any bells. Unless you know, who am I thinking of? I'm sorry, I'm going off on the name. But it opened up his film career. And, you know, it was a film that was well-received, got polite reviews, but it made money, which was the most important thing. And so they said, well, how would you like to make a real blockbuster? And, you know, Shaft holds up. Shaft really holds up. It's Friday night entertainment. It's Saturday night entertainment, right? You know, it is a genre film. It's about the black private dick who's a sex machine with all the chicks. John Shaft, right? He did not write the theme song. Isaac Hayes wrote the theme song. But it made him a wealthy man, and it opened up doors. And the thing about this, if you do a movie like this, then the next movie you get to do is a serious one, right? So he made a movie about Hughie Ledbetter, Lead Belly, the blues singer. It's a biographical film of him. It's really good. He made the first film adaptation of 12 Years a Slave, which it wasn't in theaters, but it screened on PBS. It's really good. So it's worth watching. And so, you know, he was a really great filmmaker. I would never say that as a filmmaker he had the same impact as he did as a photographer. You know, it was as a photographer that he had his impact on American society, and he had it at a particular time, the long civil rights movement. So, wrapping up, Frederick Douglass, the great abolitionist, right? Born a slave on the eastern shore of Maryland, escaped from slavery in Baltimore, goes on to found the North Star, which is an abolitionist newspaper, was a very, very famous public speaker. Abolitionist, wrote himself a series of autobiographies. One of the most important men in 19th century American history. was also one of the first theorists of photography. He wrote extensively on photography, which is, at the time, was more or less brand new. Photography was invented in 1839. And he's got this great line about photographers, picture makers, right? Picture makers see what ought to be by the reflection of what is and endeavor to remove the contradiction. And so Parks saw the promise of American democracy. He also understood what is the reality of American racism. But that removing the contradiction, right? You know, I teach at Thomas Jefferson's University, right? And so I'm just so aware of how Jefferson himself embodies this contradiction. Is Jefferson wrote the first draft of the Declaration of Independence, where he says, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness," right? And he owned slaves. And he never got rid of his slaves. And everything he owed in life was to his position as a slave owner in a slave-owning society. It's that contradiction. But Parks, like so many other picture makers, saw that contradiction and tried to remove it. So I'm going to let Gordon have the last word. This is sort of towards the end of his life. Like I said, he did a lot of writing and reflecting. And he's thinking about what he had done, and poverty and bigotry would still be around. But at last I could fight them on even terms. The significance was a choice of weapons with which to fight. So thank you very much. Yes, of course. I was hoping that I would have more time for questions. I'm sorry about that, but yes, sir.
I'm you know, kind of surprised once again to be reminded how much freedom he had.
Oh, he did, yeah.
But how do you explain him having that much freedom when Henry Luce was the publisher and an extremely conservative and very political person for both, with a lot of control over both time and life.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Henry Luce, for those of you who don't know, was the Rupert Murdoch of his time. He had founded Time Magazine, Fortune Magazine, Life Magazine, Sports Illustrated. He was a media magnate. I mean, and his publications made money hand over fist. He was conservative. He was, but it was two things. It was a kind of conservatism that doesn't exist anymore, right? So it was that sort of East Coast patrician conservatism. And it was a conservatism that allowed for liberalness on certain social issues, one of which was race. So I'm not saying that Henry Luce was way out there as an integrationist, but he was a good half step, maybe a full step, ahead of the American public. Right? And the editors that he had working for him at Life Magazine, most of them were also liberal people, right? And then thought, maybe some things have to change. So during the 1950s, Parks is establishing himself at Life. And so he's doing that Harlem Family, he's doing the segregation story, but he's not doing any writing yet. 1961, he starts writing. By the time he does the Black Muslim story, where he gets really personal and direct, Luce is out of the picture. Right, so Luce isn't involved in day-to-day operations of Life anymore. And I think that opens up some space for Life. The other thing about that is by that time, Parks himself had become famous, and there was a hierarchy at Life among the photographers. And he was one of the people at the top. He had earned his way up there. He was one of the rock stars. And his editors knew that he was one of the reasons that people subscribed to Life magazine. They liked his stuff. They wanted to see Gordon Parks work. And so I think, he had leverage. He had leverage. In part because, of those hundreds of letters that are pouring into the office. And the editors knew that those hundreds of letters were coming in. And the editors knew that most of the people writing those hundreds of letters were also going to send in renewal, So, yeah, I mean, it's a particular moment, right? And, he's I said earlier that he was riding a tide, and this is a moment where the doors are opening, and I think you and I can both sort of remember the early 60s at least. I mean, there was optimism, right? You know, I'm a little too young to remember the Kennedy administration all that well, but, you know, I do know, because I'm an historian, that there was this sense that this is a change, this is a new generation, you know, this handsome young man, John Kennedy, with his beautiful young wife, represent a new dawn for America. And there was a moment, you know? Yeah. So I think Parks had great timing. Yes, sorry, I didn't see.
Which of his four biographies, or three biographies and one autobiography?
They're all memoirs, and I would say the first one is called A Choice of Weapons. It's been in print ever since he published it in 1965. I mean, it's never gone out of print.
Does he talk about instances that he experienced?
Oh, yeah.
Prejudice and working
absolutely
ahead of time, mm-hmm. and people find legend here and there?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's very clear about the incidents of racism that and that he experienced, but also how, you know, what we call structural racism shaped his life, right? Limited the ways, the paths that he could take, and the choices that he could make. So I would say Choice of Weapons is really great. If you want to read about Life magazine, you're going to be disappointed because it stops before he gets to Life. And then the second best is called To Smile in Autumn, which is out of print, but used copies are all over the place. Probably the library has them, at least downtown library. To Smile in Autumn. And there he talks about life. Yes, sir.
When Parks started doing filmmaking, and writing, did he largely stop doing photography, or does he have like a later period of photography after Life?
No, that's a great pick. That's a great question. During the 1940s, he goes on the staff on Life magazine 1949. So 1949 and all through the 50s, he's a very busy photographer. He's shooting everything that Life assigns him to do. I mean, he'll be shooting celebrities and shooting the funeral of Babe Ruth and shooting fashion and shooting hard news, and he's really, really busy. By the 60s, he's established enough at Life that he can turn down assignments. And so for the next decade, he's only going to do the ones that he really wants to do. And so that story's like Harlem Family, or like The Nation of Islam, and fashion. He still wants to shoot a lot of fashion. So, yeah, he's very selective. And that opens up space for him to do some writing. He's always tinkered around at writing. You know, he wrote his first short story like 1950 or something like that. So, you know, that 1963 novel didn't come out of nowhere. And the same thing with his filmmaking. He made some documentary shorts before he made his first feature film. And so he had experience of putting movies together, right? So it's not that, you know, it's not sudden. He's preparing himself for an opportunity that may come along, and it did. But you're right. And when he's doing all the writing and all the movies, he's backing away from photography. And then by the time he makes Shaft, he's not doing any photography at all anymore, except for himself. And so there's an entire body of work that are color abstract photography that's all about color and shape. And it's got, you know, there are no people, there are no figures, there's no nothing. And he did that for himself.
But it was like published or like?
Yeah, he was an amazing guy. He published like 6 books of poetry. So if you get one of his poetry books, the poetry books are illustrated by these color abstract photographs, right? Which look like nothing. I mean, that's the wrong way to say it. I'm not an art historian, right? So I don't have the language to talk about his abstract. But they are beautiful, but it is about the interplay of color and shape and light and shadow, without any reference to, right, the physical world. But yeah, his books of poetry, there are lots of them out there, and once again, they're really easy to find used. And they're cheap. They're not collectible yet.
Right. Did he have children that may have followed in photography?
Right? Yeah, absolutely. Yes. Gordon Parks Jr. was a very talented photographer and filmmaker who was tragically killed in a small plane accident when he was in Africa working on a film. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, he died at age, I think he was 37. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, a real heartbreak, a real heartbreak. A daughter called Tony, who was a good photographer. You know, not the level of success of her father or anything like that. And then the youngest son from the first marriage is David. He's still alive, and he's a documentary filmmaker. So, yeah, some have followed. Absolutely, yes.
Are there books that have curated images like those that would be featured in Time?
Yeah, like there absolutely are. So a big exhibition of his photography just closed at the National Gallery in Washington, D.C., but if you say go to Amazon and search for Gordon Parks, there have been a series of exhibitions of his photographs based on the various Life magazine stories over the last few years. So there was an exhibition at the High Museum in Atlanta that was about the segregation story color photographs. There was an exhibition at the New Orleans Museum of Art that was about the Harlem family photo essay. That one came to the Fralin at UVA. There was one at the Art Institute of Chicago that was on his collaboration with Ralph Ellison. So, and there are others that I'm not even remembering right now. So if you go to a place like Amazon and start looking, you'll find a lot. But the best introduction is actually a used book, and it's called Half Past Autumn.
I have that.
Yeah, there you go. And Half Past Autumn is a really comprehensive overview of his career that also has little snippets of autobiographical writing in it. Half Past Autumn. And used copies are, like I said, you'll find it real easily. Yes, sir?
I've seen the learning tree, and as you said, it's not a very good breaking. It's not a high-quality movie. The chaps don't hold up black and white. Where did he get the funding for the learning tree? I mean, even though it wasn't a very high-quality film,
yeah,
the message in it was pretty strong, and for the time that it was created, I never understood where he got the money.
Okay, so, you know, he makes the film 1968. It's a time when, you know, black people are in vogue, right? People want to know about us, you know? And he had met John Cassavetes, the actor. And Cassavetes was a big fan of the novel and said, Parks, you can do this. You can make a movie. And it was John Cassavetes that opened the door in Hollywood. And once they got to talking, I can't remember which studio did it, but the studio had said, okay, we can be convinced that we can make some money on this as long as we don't spend too much money on it. And so Parks worked with a really small budget. There was a reason he was his own cinematographer. There was a reason why, you know, he wrote the music himself. And he was a gifted musician, so that's not a problem, but he couldn't afford to hire the other ones. But the movie made much more money than anybody expected it to. I mean, it did. You know, it got very respectful reviews. You and I don't like it all that much, but it got very respectful reviews. And people went to see it, you know? So that, once, you know, the studio saw he could make money for them, hey, fine, no problem at all. So, yeah, look, it would have been different if the movie had bombed, right? But the movie made money, and that's all that matters. To the studio.
Had it bombed,
he would have gone, who knows what he would have done. Well, go back to, well, life was out of business. Life went out of business in 72. So he would have had a couple of more years of life, but he would have had to figure out what else to do. Okay, well, thank you all for coming.
I really enjoyed getting to hear from Dr. John Edwin Mason about the life and work of Gordon Parks, and hope that you enjoyed it as well. I just want to point out that he does mention a family photo event that took place at the Jefferson School African American Heritage Center on March 9th. So we'll include links to information about that event in our show notes.
He also mentioned that he'll be moderating an event during this year's Virginia Festival of the Book. If you're listening to this episode when it comes out, that event will be next Saturday at 10 a.m. The session is titled Complicated Lives in the Civil Rights Era and will take place at the Jefferson School African American Heritage Center. We'll include a link to that event in our show notes.
This podcast is made possible through generous support from the Friends of the Library. If you'd like to learn more or join the Friends, please head to their website at jmrlfriends.org.
And please hit subscribe wherever it is you're listening to the podcast. If you have books that you'd like us to read and discuss or topics that you'd like to hear on a future episode, please email us at podcasts@jmrl.org. That's all for us today. Thanks for tuning in, and we're glad to be
on the same page.